The first series of 2022 is brought to you with the kind support of Herd Capital, a Chicago-based asset manager that invests in public equities in the technology, media, telecommunications, financial, and industrial sectors. The firm was founded in 2011 and manages assets via a long-short fund and a long-only fund. Our next guest is based in Kuwait. She has had an extraordinary career that fuses investment strategy, advice on decision-making, and cancer patient advocacy. Find out how they fit together and how things are not always as they seem. Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Dr. Rania Azmi, who is the founder of Alexandrite Decisions, a NATO-registered management consultancy and training firm that fuses her three interests of investment strategy, academia, and cancer patient advocacy. Based in Kuwait, she was strategic advisor to the Kuwait Sovereign Wealth Fund for over 10 years, and has had a long career in academia and is a member of the Executive Education Board at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. One of her particular interests is decision-making. Welcome, Rania. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with your career journey and maybe right back to where you grew up. So where did you grow up? What did you study? And how did you come to enter the world of finance and investing?
Well, it's an interesting long story. So I grew up in Kuwait, between Kuwait and Egypt, as a matter of fact, early in my studies and career. Interestingly, it was between family offices and academia. Academia was the second choice back in the time before I got graduated in my senior years. I grew up in the region, and right after I graduated, I started to travel internationally. The United States was one of the very first countries where I visited. And more or less, my upbringing, my surrounding in the two countries, and the starting to travel internationally shaped the early years of my career and my focus on decision making. I was into business management, finance, and investment, and then investment decision making. So this is a long story short.
That's really fascinating. I'd love to dig in a little bit to the investment decision-making part. So can you tell me what your approach to that is and what you think it is that would enable us to make better decisions?
Absolutely. So being in academia, and I graduated first of my class, so I was teaching finance and investment very early in my years, I was very fascinated about the theories that shape the financial markets and how investors should be rational and the many assumptions for selecting portfolios and how you select stocks or other asset classes in your investment portfolio as a private or institutional and government investors. And then it came to my mind, especially the trigger was the financial crisis, that all of these are these theories and backgrounds we taught and we were teaching in the universities at the local level and globally are very respectful, but yet not practical. There is something missing. There are some gaps in practice. So that's what triggered me to dig deeper into how the decision-making is made. In order to make any decision in life, not only investment, it requires you to be fully aware of your alternatives or options. If some of these options are blacked out for one reason or another, it means that you cannot make a good decision because you will make a choice that excludes these factors that are not in the table right now. And by the same token, if you have way too many options, it means that you will be paralyzed to make a decision. So why I'm saying this in this analogy? In the investment world, it's extremely important to try to have a direction as opposed to the noise. And academia is very good in providing this solid background, but then I needed to see what's happened in the real world. And that's what took me to a framework called goal programming. And it's not like your computer programming, it's your aim programming. So you are taking real world problems and trying to put a modeling for them without simplifying or oversimplifying the problem. And that basically putting these factors into a model and looking into what would be feasible to apply and to accomplish here, not an ideal solution that pleases the mathematical models or academic models with no use in the practical world. So I hope your followers are still following with me. I know it's just highly complicated at this point.
Well, no, it's fascinating. And I've been curious as to how much time you recommend people spend going back over past decisions, sort of post-mortems, and trying to glean lessons from that. Or do you think there's any point in that?
Well, there's always interesting caution or advice that past is not an indication of the future, especially when we talk about investments. But my personal opinion that is evidence-based, I would say, in the investment world, we need to take lessons from the past, but not to spend that much time because you will lose direction. I made the decision in the past. It has to be my advice. It has to be based on objective factors, not subjective. Not that I am taking a decision intuitively or based on my experience, which is a very respectful criteria. Experience matters, but it has to be consistent. And it has to be based on a framework. So you can check what went wrong and draw some lessons and move on in the future. So not much time, I would say, but it has to be looked at to have some lessons and do continuous improvement.
Really interesting. And I think also it's so difficult to draw a causal link in decision-making, especially in investment, because there is so much noise and so many unique factors. But I often think it's important to look at whether the process was correct or could that have been improved, as opposed to simply looking at the outcome, which may be hard to draw. Just want to move from that to your decade you spent as an advisor to one of the largest sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East. I know you can't reveal much proprietary there, but just in general, abstract terms, what would you say are the major trends in the region? And what would you say maybe were some of the major things on your mind in that role?
Well, this is a very important question because during my time spent there, I took some time on my personal vacations to try to be connected to the industry at the local, regional, and global level. So I was doing many speaking engagements independently to benchmark where I stand, and it shouldn't be, or at the time, I was very keen to have it very independent to see how the world is thinking about asset management and about sovereign funds and about how we can invest the strategic trends. So it has been an interesting 10 years in my career, thanks to this global exposure in parallel and also the mandate there. And as you rightly said, actually, there are many confidentialities and issues involved, especially it was a critical time that I joined was just before the financial crisis started in 2007. And I left at the time which was perceived to be a sensitive time to some of the world sovereign funds in 2017, which was, I would say, an informed decision to leave at that point. So the main things that moved the region, and I would say moved the world back in the time, was the financial crisis, the dynamics that happened afterwards in the aftermath of the financial crisis, and the mini crises, I would call them, like the sovereign debt crisis in some of the European countries, the debt ceiling issue in the United States, and many issues related to budgeting and diversifying the economy away from oil for oil exporting countries. These are fundamental, deep issues in the economies of some of the countries that influence how the world collectively would perceive any movement in terms of money movement or asset investment movement. So I tend to see the bigger picture. That would be the key token, is to look into strategic trends and how they shape the future. Not that we are pretending to look into a crystal ball or anything, but it really provides a perspective. And something like, I'll give just a very extreme example, like the geopolitical risks. Some of the investors or technocrats in institutional investing industry would think about them as a very distant dynamic or trend or factor when they are deciding on where to invest region-wise or asset class or even sector-wise as the main three criteria for selecting assets. But it's not that distant. If we look into what happened in Yemen, Iraq, Libya, we would never have imagined in 2021 or even 2020, and I'm not getting into COVID story yet, that we would have a failing state. And that has its ramifications around the world. It's not only pertaining to one region or to one country. We like it or not, the world is an ecosystem. What we do in any part of it impacts the rest of the world. That's what we need to learn. And I think COVID crisis now, beginning of last year, manifested that, but we still have a long way to learn as a humanity. I hope I didn't deviate much from your question.
No, really fascinating insights in the region. And in terms of your decision to launch your own consulting firm, what drove that?
Well, I thought to myself, I'm not getting any younger. And I like that this phase of my life to have more, I wouldn't call it meaningful because I always keen to have meaningful business or personal relationships, but I really needed to have some more independence and to have more global exposure, which I had, but in limitation. But to tell you the truth, the real trigger was my volunteering activities in the cancer space, because I was active as a patient advocate over 10 years ago. And then with the help of friends and close circle, we founded a charity association based in Geneva. And I was elected to lead it. So I think it was a trigger because I got independent in deciding on which volunteering activities we should do, driving the whole agenda for cancer advocacy, as opposed to being part of different initiatives. It was our own initiative that manifested in an organization. And now it's very solid with global memberships of different organizations that have a longer history than us, like the Union for International Cancer Control and others. So that was between 2015 and 2016. So I think it was the real trigger for me to also seek my independence in my business side of my personality or story. And that's how Alexandria Decisions came to light in 2017.
The really interesting fusion of interests. We have a lot of different layers of your career to dig into. But just first of all, before we leave your role as a cancer patient advocate, how do you seek to bring, I suppose, a value added to these patients? Was there a lack of advocacy? Is there a complexity in the system in terms of maybe coverage for some care? What was the problem that you were seeking to solve in there?
Well, this is a very important question, but I'm surprised you're asking this because we will spend hours in this topic. It's my real passion in life. But I will try to be brief. So my story, which I thought very unique to me, I discovered 10 years ago that it wasn't unique in the story about patient advocacy. So it always starts with a private crisis, like members of family or friends in your circle get touched with cancer and you are trying to support them with some information or other support. So being trained as a researcher in my doctorate and other research that I did after the fact, I was trained to look for evidence-based information. So it was very easy for me to seek information that are credible. And using my mindset, it wasn't even difficult to put these practical information or scientific information into action. Things related to nutrition, restoring energy, dealing with emotions, and many of the things that now are labeled as quality of life aspects for cancer patients and actually to the public, to any person. So when I started to do this, I discovered information that are very basic, very simple, but yet not accessible to patients at the local level, at the regional level. And I discovered at the global level, because in starting this initiative, in seeking information, I went to Living Beyond Breast Cancer conferences, one of the distinguished organizations in the United States. Susan Kuhlman, I joined their advocate in science community. And in Europe, there has been, I call it my dedicated school in oncology. I call it that way, but it's called ABC, Advanced Breast Cancer Consensus Conference, happening every 2 years. I always say I went there with my information about cancer below zero. And then in 2 years, I started to publish abstracts in cancer journals. Publishing in investment journals is something normal to me, but publishing in cancer journals was very, I would say, thrilling because it's outside my field at the time. And also presenting some thoughts in support groups internationally and locally, and some poster sessions. So back to your question, lack of advocacy or lack of information. In cancer, there will always be that gap of information power between the scientific community. I call it scientific because it includes oncologists, doctors, nurses, and everyone that has access to credible and reliable research and guidelines information. And you have the public. In some regions and some countries, still as we speak, they would shy away from knowing anything related to cancer. In some families, they would shy away from calling it cancer. They call it the evil disease in the local language. They even would be afraid to pronounce the word cancer. So you have this gap. The public would shy away from knowing anything related to that because it's the evil disease until someone they know touched with that disease. And it will be a very tiring, sad, anger story to try to get in the top of things. And then there's much to be done in awareness in that space. And then when you dig deeper into different levels of cancer, because cancer globally, it's just agreeable that it is handled by four phases or steps. Prevention is key, but if it's not possible, we go to early detection. And then when it happens, proper diagnosis and treatment, and in a late stage, it would be palliative care. So in each of these phases, there are many things to be done and all related to the quality of life and will inform cancer patients, their loved one, and their caregivers. And then in the wake of COVID, we need to prevent everything related to infection because it takes lives. There is a saying that most of the cancer patients die from complications, not cancer itself, which is very sad. I never realized that until last year. It was in the wake of COVID and other issues that really some of the side effects of advanced cases can be confused with symptoms of infection, severe infection or sepsis, which can take lives in less than a week compared to cancer. So there are much to be done in this space, and that's what keeps us passionate about this cause. And I will stop there because I told you I can speak for hours.
Well, I always think it's fascinating to hear people describe their passion. And thank you from the bottom of my heart for the work you're doing, because clearly it is much needed. We'll just move from there to, you mentioned some of the director roles or board roles you have. You have a series of them as well as consultant roles. What do you seek to bring to these roles? And what do you think is the key feature of an effective director, a board member, or a chair even?
I would say always think outside the box. Always try to bring something new, and new not into having a trending or something in fashion. New as to try to make the life of your constituents easier, whether it's a charity board membership or it's a business one or related to academia or the industry. You are there to provide a sounding board, to provide a good guidance or to support the decision-making. So it would be very helpful to get your records straight. Try to be informed yourself and up to date for the happenings. And try, as I said earlier, to navigate the noise, providing direction. So we all see these trends, and I call it switch-on society. We are always switched on in terms of news and trends and things happening in the world. But these, if we cannot draw patterns or trends or even analytics of these huge information, flow of information, they will be of no use. And worst yet, they can provide confusing signals. So the key role for any board or leader or business director is to provide that direction based in informed, I would call it evidence-based or credible information that you process them one way or another to give you that direction instead of noise.
Very interesting. Well, let's move now from your personal career journey into some comments maybe on the investment world. You both have worked in the investment world as well as now are involved in some of the academia, say working with the new investment members of the future. What are your thoughts on the current levels of diversity in the industry? And do you think it's improving?
I think it's much improving. If we have these time frames of 5 years or 10 years or 15 years ago, it definitely improved, but I can still see some deviations or undercurrent in some individual cases. And I have to say something in this regard for the diversity, especially for female representation in investment committees or board of directors, I am against having a quote for that representation. It has to be merit-based. So if there is a lack of diversity based on merit, that would be somehow acceptable, although I would find it very hard to believe that there is no qualified female and male caliber out there in the universe, especially across regions, because it's a highly interconnected world. So you can find, if you are keen on diversity, you really can find the caliber you want with the social media and the very world we just described being interconnected and complex. But if it's based on quota, like I have this 5% and anyone in my way, I will just fill it, this will not further the objective of the board and certainly not the cause of diversity. So it improved, but some gaps remains for understandable reasons. I would urge every party involved to do a little more effort to make that happen because it really matters. The way we wired as women and men, the way we think, and there has been many studies, by the way, in different fields, not only investment in sports, in management, in healthcare, saying that female managers tend to provide or to deliver better performances. And I have to be careful here not to upset any male listening to us right now. Just no offense, but in the investment industry, at least, I did a similar research that was published in the Financial Times newspaper 2 years after the fact. So I published that in 2009, and it was in the newspaper, I think 2010 or 2011, if I remember correctly. And the evidence basically found that female fund managers do a better job than their male counterparts. And they attributed that to two things. Female fund managers tend to be more risk averse than their male counterparts. And the other one, don't laugh at me, they tend to be less overconfident. And overconfidence has been studied for different reasons, and it can be counterproductive. Being overconfident about your decisions can get you in trouble, especially in the financial markets, we know, for the many reasons I hinted about them earlier in our conversation.
Well, that's fascinating, especially as you are a decision-making expert. I think the role of overconfidence is probably quite important in there. Just given your vantage point in the Middle East, I'd love to ask us about the ESG, a state of ESG awareness, I suppose, and ESG integration in the investment side of things. Have you had much exposure to this style of investing? And we've already touched on it in terms of gender diversity, because that obviously impacts the S. How is this style of investing being embraced in the Middle East? How is it being taught in business schools?
It started, I would say, one of my early exposure to that was before graduation back in Egypt. I was attending a high-level meeting with ministers, obviously, as part of my family office back in the time. It was 1999. I graduated in 2000, exactly, the millennium. So it was about one of socially responsible projects. So I'm giving this vivid example that I lived in over, I would say, 22 years ago, that has been a focus on ESG in the region, but not as much as compared to the Western world, like in North America and Europe. Also, I would say the shortcoming in considering social responsible or ESG in general projects in the region, although they would consider such projects, the main decision makers in the government and private sector in the region, they still apply for-profit or other projects criteria into them, which is not fair because we are talking about long-term social impact. We are talking about long-term economic and social impact. So you cannot apply similar criteria to for-profit investment that you look into risk-adjusted return or what's in it for you, when will be your payback, the initial investment, when you will get it back. It will be unfair. And I think that's the shortcoming in the region for the last 20 years. But that improved, I would say, in the last 7 to 8 years, in my humble opinion. I see appetite for these projects. And now some individual private and family businesses looking into this investment as an integral part of their portfolio and their focus. And likewise, the governments. But obviously, more focus should be there. I am one of the people that think individually and institutionally through Alexandrite that this should be even more focused than a normal or orthodox investment, because from the very crisis we have been facing, from the financial crisis over a decade ago to the current COVID situation, we share the same planet. Everything we do would impact each other. Again, to what I mentioned earlier, it's an ecosystem. So in that regard, ESG is just extremely important.
Yeah, that's so interesting how you made the distinction between long-term and short-term returns. I think we don't always look at it in that sense. And that is a really important holistic way, because most of the investors that you've worked with, I'm sure, and certainly that I've worked with, are very long-term investors. So I suppose we do need to change the time frame against which we measure some of these. So just going back to your personal story, were there any key people in your career who influenced you, whether in your career or in life in general?
Absolutely. First and foremost are my parents. My mom and my dad have been always my cheerleaders, the ones that always listen to your stories and encourage you. I would say as a young lady, I would never have been where I am right now in this part of the world without their support. So unfortunately, I lost my mom last year. So may God bless her in paradise. And she was a great influencer, especially in the charity side, in the Cancer Association. So the Cancer Association that I started or co-founded is called Fadia Survive and Thrive. Fadia is my mom's name. So while she was alive, she was the main supporter in this association and also in my career. But that's just a vivid example. They have been the main influencer. And obviously, I met many walks of life, many people around the world. I started to count the cities actually at a request and encouragement from my mom back in the time. Said, like, you're traveling a lot, you should pay attention, just pause and reflect, and draw some lessons. So she was my mentor as well in this regard. So I visited over 80 cities in 30-something countries, seeing different professionals, people at their simplest way. It's very humbling, and that we feel it or not unconsciously shape our personality and make us very stronger and at the same time very humbled. It's that equation that you are not living in your own bubble. You have seen different nation, different cultures, different ways of doing business, different confidence, different fragilities. It just, you have seen everything. And if I give the analogy of the picture that NASA took for Earth from distance, and there was an author who wrote a book about this picture, it's called The Pale Blue, that the whole universe from distance, the whole Earth, everything we do in this earth, wars and crises and investments and humanitarian or not, we are very, even not a clear blue dot. We are a pale blue dot. And there are other galaxies and things beyond our comprehension. So we need to be more humbled and also stronger as we go about in this life.
That's really fascinating. So you've traveled to 80 countries. And obviously, this is an audio only, so people can't see you, but you are a Muslim woman, you wear a hijab. How has that experience been for you?
It was very interesting. Early in the years, in the aftermath of 9/11, the world became so different in terms of traveling and restrictions in airports. So I always hear back home, be careful. Oh, do you have to go to that trip? Do you have to travel to this country? Knowing that there are restrictions and someone that they knew faced some problems. So I would share, for me, I consider myself lucky. But at the same time, I would say my conviction is if you give kindness and if you're doing your part, I think the other party or who you are dealing with should be with the same wavelength. And so I might say I'm lucky because I have been always in exposure with like-minded people. So I didn't face that problem. But I would share with you in the beginning when I traveled, they had these restrictions in airport where you need to take off your jacket. It wasn't a restriction at the time prior to that. I'm talking about maybe 20 years or 19 years ago, one of my first trips to the US. I remember the security guard at this checkpoint control saying something very lightly, and I couldn't hear him. And I said, pardoned me for 2 times and he's still speaking very quietly that I cannot hear him. And I said, really, speak out. I cannot hear you. And then he said in a very fainted voice, can you please take off your jacket? And I said, of course, I know about this. So I was prepared to wear something underneath. I was wearing a blouse, dress, and then a jacket. It was winter in January, traveling to Chicago, by the way. So he was very polite in asking this, seeing my veil, like a Muslim veiled woman for him. And the other incident is, I don't know if this, I should say it in public, but it's no harm. One of the trips to Monte Carlo was for a conference during Ramadan month, the fasting month. And I really, one of the persons that would never order room service. I cannot eat in the room. In this European city, breaking the fast would be close to 10 p.m. And then we need to be prepared for the other meal early morning, like around 2 or 3 a.m. I would say Monte Carlo is one of the cities that the safest in the world. You can, as a lady, you can walk maybe 2 a.m. with full jewelry on and nothing would happen. So that was one of the interesting encouragement to walk there and have a meal, a proper meal in one of the famous hotels bar. So that was interesting thing to walk in with my scarf on. And again, I was welcomed as a guest. No such discrimination or perceived different treatment. And on a professional level, there are some issues related to wearing scarf, and it relates to, I would say, misconception and lack of understanding from different parts in some European countries that in other religions, wearing a headscarf is to show that you are religious. But in Islam, it's not to show that you are religious. It's one of the essentials. It's a must. The way some of us perceive it. So I'm not wearing it to show it that I'm religious. I'm wearing it for the purpose that I am Muslim and I need to be modestly covered with our modern outfits nowadays. So I'm trying to say it's not optional to uncover it when I am pleased and then cover it. I am wearing it all the time when I am outside. So that wasn't understandable in some of the European cities. So they banned it in schools, in universities. Funny enough, I was invited in one of these countries that banned it, and I was approached by some Muslim fresh students in their first year in the university and asking, we are so surprised that you are teaching here with the scarf. And I said, well, this means that your school or university is very understanding.
In terms of any a piece of advice that you might have received from some of these key influences in your life or any creed or motto that you live by, is there anything that you can share there?
Yes, there were many advices that I took throughout my different phases of career. The key among them, and I think that what shaped the majority of my personality right now, is not to autopilot your life. It's not about getting a job or settling in your personal life, like in the cultural inheritance, and I'm not necessarily against it. It's to settle, get married, have kids, or have the trophy job, the trophy husband or trophy wife, or live happily ever after. I'm not discrediting the importance of these in life, but just be aware not to autopilot your life, meaning doing things in routine. Routine is good in progressing in something to further a purpose, for example. But just to live a life doing something you are not convinced with or don't see accumulated steps to further something, that will not provide a spark in your life. So just every now and then, make a time, I wouldn't call it meditation, to just pause, slow down, reflect, see how content you are with your life, appreciate who you are, appreciate what you achieved, even if they are small achievements, or even if they are none, if you are still young and a fresh graduate. Just appreciate who you are and then move to the next step. Try to have that direction. Try to have that purpose in any direction. And every now and then, think about it, not just let the life take you. As one of the saying, I don't know who quoted that, but it's an interesting saying that life is what happens to you while you are busy with other plans. Let's not do that.
Well, no better time to remember that than now. Well, Rani, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. You've brought a lot of really interesting perspectives, not only from your cancer advocacy work, but also from your perspective based in the Middle East and in Kuwait. And thank you so much for coming here and sharing your insights with us.
Well, thank you for having me and for the excellent questions. You got the most out of me.
That I can be relied upon. I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.